This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Across Northern Ireland, on your radio and on BBC Sounds. This is
The Stephen Dolan Show!
Hello, an extraordinary interview today, thought-provoking, emotional, from a young nurse. Kayleigh's just 20. She was strangled by someone in hospital while working. And the decision by the PPS, which now because of this, the interview on this programme that you're about to hear, is under review. But the PPS eventually had decided not to prosecute the person who tried to strangle her. You'll hear all about it in this report. It's compelling.
The Stephen Dolan Show!
Good morning. Thanks for joining me today. You're about to hear a shocking story this morning about how a nurse just starting out on her career was strangled in one of our local hospitals. The Public Prosecution Service initially said they were going to charge. But they then sent this nurse, called Katie, a letter telling her they weren't doing so. They communicated with her with a letter to say that person that tried to strangle you, they're not going to be charged. Expert medical evidence was submitted by the defence, which then failed to be considered along with all the other facts and circumstances of the case. It was determined that due to the defendant's medical condition at the time of the alleged offending, there was no longer a reasonable prospect of conviction for an offence. And we wrote to the victim. Well, that starts to sound sensible, doesn't it? That there's this victim, there's this aggressor who is so mentally out of control that they didn't know what they were doing. So it starts to sound sensible, doesn't it? Then you see, you ask yourself a question, how did that aggressor walk out of the hospital? How did the hospital sign them off that they were so mentally fit that out the door they went? How many different medical reports did the PPS look at? And why on earth, if they did have to drop that case, who on earth within the Public Prosecution Service thought it was kind, fit, reasonable or fair to take a young nurse and tell her by letter that the person that had tried to strangle her would not be charged? Have a listen to the story. Katie is speaking this morning.
I am actually a student nurse. I just started in September studying, but for 2 years before that, I was a healthcare assistant.
So, Craigavon Area Hospital, you're working as a nurse. What happened to you?
I had went in to do a night shift, and the start of the night was okay. And then whenever it started to get into the smaller hours of the morning, I was attacked by a patient and strangled on the ward in front of other patients and other workers.
Strangled? Can you describe what this person did?
He actually grabbed me at the back of my head with one of his hands while I was trying to assist him over to the bed. And
so grabbed you by the hair? Is that right?
Yes, by the back of the neck, yeah. Just the lower bit of my head, and tried to push me to the floor. But because of the way I was standing, I had my legs spread out a bit. He wasn't able to get me down. I then told him, you know, you need to let go of me. Please let go of me. And they tried again to push me down. And I said, right, that's not funny. Stop. Like, don't do that to me. Let go of me. And that's when they changed their grip to being one hand behind my head, pushing me to round my neck, trying to stop me breathing with the amount of pressure.
So you were on the ground at this stage, were you?
No, I was still stood beside them.
And this man, was he bigger than you?
Yes, quite a bit bigger than me.
And I'm looking at my hand now. I'm trying to imagine the specifics of this. So the grip of his hand is around your neck. Is that what you're saying?
Well, it was mostly, his hand was so big compared to my neck. I would say it was mostly just his thumb. And sort of that part of your hand. His full thumb and like a bit of his palm and the rest of his fingers was round the side of my neck. Thankfully, I was able to hold his other hand in my hand so that he wasn't able to get it around my neck as well, or I think it would have been a lot worse off than what it was.
How hard was he pushing on your throat?
Well, I was trying to scream and I couldn't make any noise because he was squeezing so hard.
So you were choking?
Yeah, I couldn't breathe.
My goodness. How terrifying.
Yeah.
My goodness. Was he saying anything? What was the look? What was he looking angry? Was he?
He was very angry looking at me. I can't really remember what he was saying because in my head at the time I was thinking he's going to kill me and I can't do anything about it.
My goodness.
But
you're trying then. You're trying to scream out for help. But
yeah,
he's got such a force on your neck. You can't.
Yeah, there was no noise coming out. And that's then when the other healthcare assistant that was in the room with me, she was at the other side of the bed and she started screaming and the two nurses came running down and herself and they were able to get him off me.
Why had he targeted you?
I'm not too sure, to be honest. I think it could have been anybody that was there, female-wise. Whenever the security man came up, he all of a sudden had no memory of what happened and was very submissive and sat down and listened to them, whereas he was very angered, he had so much anger towards the female staff and shouting at us and telling us to basically F off, you know, whenever we were trying to sort him out. But he was just so violent feeling in that time.
And was this man being treated in hospital for any type of psychiatric disorder or anything which, you know, wouldn't alleviate your pain, but it might explain his behaviour?
Well, actually, in handover, at the start of each shift, there's a half an hour handover from day shift to night shift workers or night shift to day shift, and in my handover it was told to us that mental health had actually discharged him that morning and that they didn't see that they could help him anymore or that he didn't need their help. It was also handed over to us that the family was coming in the next morning for the conversation of he needs to go home because he's taken up a bed that other people would benefit from. That
after your colleagues helped you get him off your neck, you then were walking past his room after the incident and he said something to you, didn't he?
Yeah. After it happened, I was put in a different room and the nurses checked me over and everything. And I got in contact with everyone that I needed to inform that it had happened. And a few hours later, whenever they decided that they were happy, like, to let me go home, and I was going to get my stuff from the nurse's station in the corridor of the ward. I had a jumper and a charger or something sitting, and I was lifting it and walking out, and I would love to be able to remember what he said to me word by word, but I can't. But he said something out the door to me whenever I was walking past, like, as if he, it felt threatening to me that if,
what was the meaning of it? You're being honest enough to say, excuse me, you can't remember the specific words, but you do remember the specific meaning, don't you?
Yeah, it was as if he would have hurt me more if other people hadn't have came. I can't remember word for word what it was, but I remember at the time thinking, like, I'm so thankful that the nurses came as quick as what they did, because me, myself, I wouldn't have been able to get him off me.
Did he intimate as you were walking past whether he intended to do it again?
It felt, I can remember the feeling of feeling like that's what was intended, but because I can't remember what he said word for word, I don't want to say that he said something that he hasn't, but it felt like he was trying to intimidate me more.
So you went to the police, police investigated, file sent to the Public Prosecution Service. Public Prosecution Service decided initially to prosecute, correct?
Yeah. I got a letter to say that it was going to be investigated and like a copy of what the prosecution was going to be, and the case references and all the details of what I would need to be able to look and see what was going on with it. But then not long after, I got a letter to say that actually there was insignificant evidence to provide a reasonable prospect of conviction.
Insufficient evidence?
Yeah.
That's what it said in the letter.
Yeah.
Well, how's there... You're trusted enough to be caring for us all in a hospital. How is your first-hand testimony and the fact that your colleague witnessed a man trying to strangle you not sufficient evidence?
Well, I'm not too sure, to be honest. It says in the letter as well that a psychiatrist had seen them, and that, in quotes, it says, given the level of delirium present, I do not believe that this person could have formed the necessary mens rea for an offence of non-fatal strangulation at the time of the alleged offence, but he was discharged from and deemed compos mentis from mental health that morning. And he was seen by multiple other staff and other people. So I don't understand how there's not enough evidence.
In what ways has this left you feeling?
Well, whenever I got the first letter saying that it was going to be looked into, I didn't feel anxious about going to work anymore. I didn't feel anxious about going on and studying at uni. I was like, brilliant, that's going to be sorted. But now, since I got that second letter to say that he's basically not going to get in trouble for trying to kill me, I'm nervous coming to work. I haven't been sleeping. I just feel really let down.
Okay, then, I'm sorry. You're not sleeping?
No, it's just, sorry. It's just playing over and over in my head. And just trying to make sense of how they're deeming it not enough evidence, and how they're saying that he was delirious at the time, whenever I know he wasn't.
Did they ever come back to you to ask for more information and ask you about his state of mind at the time, or say to you they were minded to say that he was delirious? Had you any additional witnesses, additional information?
No, they haven't contacted me other than the night I gave my statement and these two letters.
These two generic letters, presumably, are they?
Yeah. There's nothing really on them other than telling me that they're looking into it and then telling me they're not.
How long ago did this happen?
In August, the start of August.
So you're just starting out in nursing?
Yeah, I was just about to start university, so as you can imagine, it was a very big deterrent on me wanting to go.
Are you going to go?
Well, I have, because I thought that something was maybe going to be done about it, but now I know that I have a career ahead of me, that someone could do this to me all the time and nothing be done about it is slightly off-putting.
That can't be right. That cannot be right. Obviously, there's a high threshold for a criminal conviction in many cases. And if there is a psychiatric report showing that this person didn't know what they were doing, the PPS would need to take that into consideration. Let's have a look at the PPS statement that they've sent through to the Nolan Show. All decisions, they say, on whether to prosecute are taken by independently and impartially applying the test for prosecution. Standard of proof needed for a criminal prosecution is high. For a conviction, the prosecution must establish beyond a reasonable doubt, through available and admissible evidence, the commission of a criminal offence by the suspect. In this case, following careful consideration of all the available evidence submitted by police, a decision was taken in November 23 to prosecute an individual in connection with an assault on a healthcare worker at Craigavon Hospital on the 15th of August. They say once a decision to prosecute is taken, we have a duty to keep the test for prosecution under continuous review and to take into consideration any new evidence or information which becomes available as the prosecution progresses. After the decision to prosecute was taken, expert medical advice was submitted by the defence, which then failed to be considered along with all other facts and circumstances of the case. It was determined that due to the defendant's medical condition at the time of the alleged offending, there was no longer a reasonable prospect of conviction for an offence of non-fatal strangulation, and we wrote to the victim to inform her of this on 11th of June 2024. See, there are a number of things. Well, first of all, what's your reaction, Katie, to that statement?
I understand their process of having to go through everything and get everything correct, but it's just knowing that he was not delirious that night. I know he wasn't, and he wouldn't have been discharged from mental health that morning. And he wouldn't have, they wouldn't have been talking about letting him go home if he was delirious.
You see, I have a few questions just as a citizen, and we will go back to the PPS and ask them these questions as I read them out. But they say in their statement, after the decision to prosecute was taken, expert medical evidence was submitted by the defence. Was any medical evidence that was gathered in your hospital on that night gathered? Was any of that considered as to his state of mind by the PPS? Was the only medical evidence considered to be expert that evidence as submitted by the defence? Do you know?
Other than my statement and the other healthcare assistant's statement, I am not sure. I was in such a state of shock. I honestly don't know.
But I get that. But as you say, this man was deemed... You're saying this man was deemed compos mentis enough to be allowed into wider society again.
Yeah.
He walked out the door, didn't he?
Yeah.
So he's deemed fit to do that. The defence aren't doing anything wrong. They're submitting evidence. That's their job to do that. But the PPS ought to explain to you, the victim, what on earth, how on earth, that's European, isn't it? How do you get this situation where a man who you see and believe to be compos mentis is deemed to be delirious?
Yeah. I would just love to be able to compare the notes that we had been writing that night to whatever has been submitted. I obviously probably am not allowed to do that or see that with confidentiality and things, but I just know that as I was working, he was not, that night, he was not delirious. I want to see their reasoning for saying that he was.
What they've told the Nolan Show, the PPS, they've said we would be happy to meet with the victim in this case to explain in further detail the reasons for the decision not to prosecute and to answer any questions she may have. Do you want to take them up on that?
Yeah, I would.
They say they understand this must be deeply distressing. Do you think they really do?
Not really. Or I feel I would have got some other line of communication to talk to me about this.
Are you thinking giving up?
I was going to, but it was actually my dad that told me not to let it go.
Yeah. I meant, are you thinking of giving up nursing?
I love nursing and I love studying to be a nurse, but it just doesn't make me feel like I'm safe to work. if people are going to be allowed to do that and not have any sort of punishment for doing it.
There's two different aspects to the situation. One is the PPS need to adhere to the law, and part of the law requires someone to be of sound mind if they're going to be prosecuted for a particular crime. The other part of this story is about communication. Like, how often am I going to say this in this society of ours? A young, vulnerable nurse who has been attacked and they haven't explained to you in depth why there's no prosecution.
Yeah.
And you've been left in this state.
I just don't understand how they've been able to deem him like that whenever I've seen him, and I know myself.
Do they say in that letter there is a right to appeal?
No.
How old are you, Kelly?
I'm 20. I'm just turned 20.
Is this your first interaction with the BBC?
Yeah.
Well, it would be my honour in your first connection with the BBC to take this case on your behalf right to the very top of the Department of Health. I will get your case on the desk of the Health Minister. Would you like me to do that?
Yeah, that would be brilliant. Something might actually get done about it.
We will also contact the Public Prosecution Service and ask them and follow up on some of the questions on your behalf that we've discussed today. And I do not want you feeling alone. I really don't.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Meanwhile, you're going into hospital. You're going into hospital on a low salary, caring for us all, and you're coping with this on your own.
I know.
Right. Look, leave this with me, and you tell your dad we can't promise. PPS make legal decisions, we don't, but we can certainly get this on the desk of the powerful figures in this country to find out what protection there is for nurses, and we will do that with pleasure. Listen, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Kelly, thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Just starting out in nursing, there's the reality of 2024 working in nursing in Northern Ireland. But there are huge questions from this case. There's been a development already. We did as promised. So we went to the Public Prosecution Service and we said to them, hold on, did you gather as part of your consideration not to prosecute? Did you gather any medical evidence from the hospital as was written up on the night? We said, did you only consider the medical evidence as presented by the defence? Now, we don't know, but we asked that question. And we asked the PPS, could they explain to Katie how this person was deemed fit enough to walk back out into society? Right out the door of that hospital. But they had accepted that this person was so delirious that there was no possible chance of a prosecution. Now, the PPS, after the Dolan Show's questions, have now said this case is under further consideration. So they've now gone back and they're now reopening the possibility that Katie will get justice. It's under further consideration. That's great for Katie, but that does not stop the PPS. It absolutely, fundamentally does not stop our public prosecution service from answering a simple question if the only medical evidence that they considered was from the defence. It's a yes or a no. We don't expect them to go into detail if there is a case under further consideration. Your organisation is at the very heart of public trust in the justice system. Did you consider other medical reports? Did you consider the handover notes in that hospital written up by trained professional staff? Did you consider the mental health report that Katie said was written up by the mental health team as part of your decision making? And yet you tell the public this morning you won't answer those questions? How can we have justice? Where is your comment? Ray's in Dromore. Morning, Ray.
Good morning, Stephen. Stephen, for 31 years I've been trying to get action from the PPS on an assault, and all I get is stonewalled. Even I've asked under Freedom of Information, and I have all the responses on record. But as far as that young lady is concerned, I wish her all the very best. There's a police car stationed outside Craig Avenue Hospital for such instances whereby an assault occurs. Now, there's cameras in the hospital that record any assault or action against staff or others. Under the Offences Against the Persons Act, which I'm sure you're well aware of, Stephen, there are five categories of assault. There's murder, attempted murder, manslaughter, GBH, and bodily harm, or common assault. The PPS could have proceeded against any of those on the common assault against the person.
Well, hold on a minute. Now, you know, I am going to be fair to the PPS this morning, Ray. We're not going to start to litigate a case on air. And obviously the capacity, the mental capacity of someone who allegedly, there's no alleged about it. You know, Katie's telling us she was strangled. But it is about whether that person had the mental capacity to know what they were doing. But it is an absolute fair question. If you take what the PPS's position was until this programme got involved, that there was sufficient evidence that that person didn't know what they were doing, then obviously the very grave, imminent danger written all over it situation is how does someone who the PPS accepts was delirious when strangling people, how did they walk out the door? Why did they not go into a mental health secure unit? I want to read the PPS statement in full. And I would urge the Public Prosecution Service, join up with the community. I explain to them what the generalities are here. And there is absolutely no logical reason why you can't tell the public of Northern Ireland whether other reports were also considered as well as the defence's report. There's no reason you can't do that. It does not interfere with your review. You know it right now. And the person who's asking that question is Katie, is a 20-year-old who was strangled, who can't sleep at night. Now, the full PPS statement is as follows to the Nolan Show. The case is under further consideration and we will be making direct contact with the victim to discuss the case. As the decision-making process is now under review, it would not be appropriate to comment further at this time. Appropriate for who? It wouldn't be appropriate for you, the Public Prosecution Service? Or it wouldn't be appropriate in the public interest? Which is it? Philip in Belfast. Morning, Philip.
Morning, Stephen. How are you?
Morning. Go ahead.
Stephen, I started listening to this here and I was starting to fume. I couldn't listen. See, there should have been security staff there. If someone has, let's go with psychotic illness. That's what I'm thinking it is. I have no idea, but that would probably be top of the list for that sort of thing. But where was security within that building if he was deemed...
Well, security can't be everywhere.
Yes.
But I get what you're saying. You're saying this...
Yes. Now, Stephen, I think it needs to be brought before the courts. It really does, that one. And let the end decide. I don't know what the answer is. But I got me fuming listening to it. Like, I know that. I don't know what else to say, Stephen. The security CCTV should be keeping an eye on this sort of thing. And I was in the hospital. I'd been going in there to hospitals with my mum, late mum, for years. And there was a woman who was not well, and she was, the security staff were around her. She had it in for one of the nurses, and she was constantly being monitored, like, so she was.
Philip, thank you. John Compton, former head of the Health and Social Care Board. Morning to you, John.
Morning, Stephen.
We're trying to encourage young people to join the NHS, and my goodness, we need them to feel safe when working within it. They're certainly not doing it for the money they get. So what's your reaction to what you've heard this morning?
Well, I mean, you couldn't have anything other than tremendous sympathy for Katie and the courage that she'd shown in, if you like, raising the issue and bringing it forward. You know, at 20, it takes a lot of courage to do these sort of things. So I think she's to be applauded for doing that. And she does need more support, and she does need a better result than the way in which it's been handled. These things are, there is a zero tolerance for violence in hospitals. If you go into any of the ED departments or anywhere at all, it will talk about zero tolerance for assault and for, you know, bad behaviour as regards staff. So there can be no doubt that if someone is actually physically assaulted, that's well beyond zero tolerance. The issue here, I think, is it's probably a very complicated case when you get into the whole detail of it, but you do need to have better support for the staff when it happens. This is not an unusual event, sadly, in our ED departments, as far as that's concerned. And there is a real issue about a public expectation that if people assault someone, they get prosecuted. I know that there is a reasonable line in the defence and all of that about prosecuting that. Can you guarantee a successful outcome? But there is another line in this, which is that if you're trying to do zero tolerance, we will prosecute. You know, you will have to defend yourself, and we will prosecute. And we may lose the case, and that's fine if we lose the case, but we will prosecute. I mean, and I in these sort of situations, I don't see why healthcare staff don't have the confidence and the belief that the system is designed to support them and to make sure that they are front and centre.
I think everyone understands that if there is someone lacking such capacity that they have no clue what they're doing, then it's not in the interest of justice to prosecute someone who is severely mentally ill. And that may be the case in this case. But it may not. But it may be the case. But to take a situation where you have a young nurse and her case is dropped by letter, and that's it. Like, does anybody any, well, they know now the impact it has on people.
Mm-hmm. No, well, I think that is that's the point I'm making, that this isn't an academic exercise where you're deciding whether you can prosecute or not prosecute. There are victims here. And in the health system, I think if it's staff, and in this case a young nurse just starting out in her career is the victim, then they have, I think, a complete reasonable expectation that someone will explain to them what's happening. Someone will, if you like, talk to them and have and explain why a decision's been made and what their options and what their rights are on the other side. I think simply to do it by letter is a pretty callous event, really. I mean, and pretty thoughtless. And I'm sure there's a bit of activity in the PPS this morning trying to sort of see what's the best way to handle this. And it's great that they have offered to meet with her, because I think that's important. And it's important that she goes with someone who is her representative there to, you know, because these meetings are difficult enough to handle, but you need someone with you when you're there.
John, thank you very much. Jim Gamble, former senior police officer, with us this morning. Good morning, Jim. Right, so Jim's not there. We've statements coming into us this morning from all over the place. Royal College of Nursing, they say they've been raising concerns for many years about physical and verbal abuse of healthcare staff in the workplace. They say, according to the latest RCN employment survey, almost one third of nursing staff in Northern Ireland experienced physical abuse from patients and relatives in the preceding 12 months, with two thirds experiencing verbal abuse. Both figures are higher than the UK average. The Southern Trust now responding to us today. The Trust has a number of security porters in both the Craigavon Area Hospital and Daisy Hill Hospital sites. These staff members have received specialist training in managing and responding to incidents within our emergency departments, with further escalation to the PSNI where necessary. They also wear body-worn cameras, which help act as a deterrent to reduce and prevent abuse against patients, staff and visitors. ED staff also receive training in dealing with violence and aggression. We support a culture, they say, in which we would want our staff to feel safe at work. I think Jim Gamble is with us now. Good morning to you, Jim.
Morning, Stephen.
This nurse, distressed, not able to sleep, doesn't think she gets justice, doesn't think anybody cares, doesn't know what to do, and thinks it's going to happen to her again.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you look at the statistics, you know, where I chair safeguarding boards in England, there's over 41,000 NH staff are subject to assaults. In fact, nearly 42,000 in 2023. So it's not an unusual occurrence. So it's really disturbing when you hear a case like this going to no prosecution, when clearly in the first instance it passed the evidential test. And that's not about it, you know, it being the ability to prove it. It's a reasonable expectation that it can be proved. And it then passed the public interest test if they were going to go, and the victims, you know, views are taken into account in that. So when you listen to what's actually said, you're right to touch on the points that you have. If after the fact a medical expert comes forward and says, in my expert opinion, having examined this person at the time of the incident, because I think it was interesting the way that the PPS phrased it, at the time, meaning that person, you know, may not still have that condition. So I would have expected that to go to court and for the expert testimony of one medical expert to be tested in that adversarial environment against another representing the views of the PPS. So the question you've asked is extremely pertinent. Did they go and seek alternate medical opinion? And the truth is that it's for the court to make decisions. It's passed the evidential test. It's passed the public interest test. And if they're going back retrospectively on the basis of evidence or opinion provided by the defense, then I would think the benefit of the doubt should have gone to the young nurse and not be tried, because insanity, even if it is accepted as a defense, doesn't necessarily mean a person will be acquitted. So zero tolerance is only zero tolerance when you actually follow through.
I just want to read, because you're referring back to some things that were said by the PPS in their initial statement. Just to bring people up to date, after this program's got involved, the PPS say that the case is under further consideration now, and they say that the decision-making process is under review. Now, they are then saying that because of that, they can't actually answer Katie's basic question, did they consider any other medical evidence? And can you understand how they can't answer that question, Jim? Not go into the detail of it, but just say yes or no to it.
No, I don't. But I'm not going into the detail, but let me say this. It's just too convenient to say, well, now that we've heard this program we're going into, a victim can apply for a review of a decision not to prosecute at any time. So clearly, having picked up on what you're saying, that is being preempted. But ultimately, it is a key question for the public, for public confidence in the competence of the Public Prosecution Service, to establish whether, when they're making a decision, it's an administrative tick in the box. Oh, there is a defence here, so now that reduces the likelihood of achieving prosecution, versus look at the seriousness of this case. Can we get another medical opinion? And there are two things here, Stephen. There's the aftermath and the way this has been dealt with by the PPS, but there's also issues to do with the Health and Social Care Trust. And that there should be a serious incident review ongoing in the aftermath of this to look at, number one, why was that person admitted? What was, you know, the diagnosis and prognosis, and if they were stepped down in the handover of one team to another, what was the basis of the decision that made them think that was a reasonable thing to do? And when they were discharged, what was the understanding of their diagnosis at that stage? And if they were discharged believing that they did not represent a risk to themselves or others, then you need to place that into the wider context of the decision-making of the PPS.
There's another thing that doesn't stack up for me here. It just fundamentally does not stack up for me. And I'm saying this directly to the PPS this morning. You knew, and you know that any case, as Jim is saying, can be under review. So yesterday, you were able to speak about the expert medical evidence. You were able to confirm that expert medical evidence had been submitted by the defence and was considered by you. So how on earth are you telling the public that you can't tell them whether expert medical evidence from any other party was introduced on Katie's behalf? Now, just explain that to me, of how this is a one-way system where you can publicly talk about expert evidence being submitted by the defence, but you cannot answer Katie's public question. You cannot say yes, but you can with regards to expert medical evidence introduced by the defence. How does that stack up? Jim, where should this go now?
Well, I think quite rightly it's currently being reviewed by the PPS, the decision. It'll be interesting to see the outcome of that. But I think there's an issue now of public confidence in their competence. We rely on the Public Prosecution Service to make balanced decisions, and this undermines that level of confidence. So I think there needs to be something that allows the public to be reassured about what happened in this case. And once they've finished the review, they should be, once they make a decision whether to reinstigate a prosecution or not, the information about their decision-making process should be open and transparent and available for the public to scrutinise. They are the Public Prosecution Service, and they act by, for, and on behalf of the public. And I just am concerned that they're preempting the decision that should have been made in a court, with one expert perhaps talking on behalf of the defence being challenged by another on behalf of the prosecution. So, you know, at the end of the day, we don't have all the facts. The public prosecution may have something that they don't think appropriate to share. But as you say, they had no problem saying, look, we did this on the basis of expert medical advice provided by the defence. And what we want to be reassured of is that they balanced the public interest. How do you protect the public? Is it good enough, you know, from the victim's perspective, that on this piece of retrospective medical evidence, if that's what it is, because I can't imagine a doctor from the ward on that night has come forward and given medical evidence of this type. It will be a consultant in the aftermath looking back retrospectively. So ultimately, we need to understand why this happened and how it happened. And the fact of the matter is, they're under real pressure in the public prosecution service. Let's make no mistake about that. So are the NHS. Everybody is under pressure. But we need to begin treating each other with a little bit more kindness. And for a young nurse to go through that, and let's be honest, we only introduced an offence, actually, back in 2023, of non-fatal strangulation, which this sounds like to me. So if someone has gone through that traumatic experience, an experience whereby we constructed and introduced a new offence in Northern Ireland, then I'd expect them at least to be consulted rather than getting a cursory email to say that the decision to prosecute has been withdrawn.
Jim, thank you very much. We're going to be looking at a run order here this morning, because that nurse's father is now contacting us. I can see it on the system. Eugene, morning, Eugene.
Yes, good morning.
Morning. You're a defence lawyer.
Yes, that's right, yes.
What do you think?
The reason I touch base with your researcher, Stephen, is to let the child know there is a formal review facility available, and she needs, with her father and possibly some advisors, to make contact directly now with the PPS, who will be required under their code of conduct to initiate a complete review with a separate new prosecution team.
Yeah.
And also...
And that's what the PPS are maybe doing. This is a 20-year-old.
Well, I would expect that, but I would also... The child would also need to be brought into that. And the issue in there is to what extent there will be access to the material. That's a formal scenario that I'm very much aware of as a defence lawyer, and it's taken very, very seriously, and it involves a totally independent review.
And as a defence lawyer, are you surprised that a medical report from the defence meant that this case stopped immediately?
We're going by the unilateral report at the moment, Stephen. The straight answer is yes in this regard.
Well, actually, the PPS. Sorry, I don't want to rush you, Eugene. Maybe we can wait after 10. I'm noting also, I'm taking this from memory, but I know it. The PPS said that they also considered other issues, but they just won't answer the question whether they considered other medical reports. Stay there, Eugene. We'll pick this up after 10. We're coming back. Good morning. We're coming back to this story about the nurse, Katie, who was strangled while working. And the PPS told her, and look, what a complicated job the PPS have. And they've got to gather all the evidence, and they can't change the law. And if the law doesn't allow them to prosecute, then they've got to stick to that. But the question in the public interest this morning, sorry, could somebody get me a glass of water, please? I'm choking. The question in the public interest this morning is whether other medical reports were considered, and the PPS have not answered those. Eugene's contacted us, who's a barrister. I just wanted you to finish your point, Eugene, that you were making before the news.
Yeah, I think the essential point I'm making, Stephen, is this. This is a relatively new form of charge. It was introduced, non-fatal strangulation. It was introduced because attempted murder is very difficult hurdle to get over. And ordinary assault is a very low level for this type of thing when it involves a specific strangulation activity. So the point I'm making is that it requires either a deliberate intentional act or a reckless act. Now, the medical reports are relevant to whether the suspect would have had either of those forms of either intent or recklessness in mind at the time. Therefore, the only medicals would be those that are known and relevant to him at that time. I would anticipate that the defence reports would have incorporated their history. I don't know. But at the end of the day, where I'm slightly bemused and where there should be some focus is, it's not for the medics to say whether someone harbours those forms of intent or recklessness. It's for the jury and for a judge and jury at a hearing.
Well, surely now, in defence of the PPS, Eugene, and you know a lot more about this than I do, but surely there is discretion within the PPS and they've got to make their judgment as to whether a case is likely to be successful or not. And if the medical evidence is so overwhelming that it's not, then they are entitled to say this should not go before a jury, are they not?
I couldn't agree more. I mean, they have a test. Is there a reasonable prospect? Where I think there should be some focus, however, is that unless there's a level of insanity, there is no upon which medics can come to a formal opinion. Medics can simply send to the PPS and to the lawyers all the medical history of this guy. And the question then is a focused question for the PPS. On what basis have they come to a conclusion that no jury reasonably directed could find him to be at least, at the very least, reckless? And I think there needs to be focus in such an obvious case on that. But I don't think, Stephen, honestly don't think there is going to be any other medicals that are relevant, because I would have thought that the medics at the moment have put together their opinions based on the medical history of this suspect.
Well, it's a medical, just finally, the PPS have told us it is it was a submission by the defence from a medical expert.
Yeah. But, yeah, who would be independent.
I gather all of that. But what Katie is claiming, Katie is saying that there was a mental health team inside that hospital that deemed that individual fit to leave. So was that considered?
I would be surprised if the reports didn't consider all of that. Very, very surprised. But otherwise, they wouldn't really carry any credibility.
But the PPS won't even say yes, they were considered. Anyway, Eugene,
that's what the review's about. Stephen was just hoping to help in relation to
Thank
that.
Thank you very much. You certainly have. Thank you this morning. We'll come back to this before the end of the show. Is Katie's father going to come on? Katie's father's going to speak to you all. So that'll happen before the end of the programme this morning. Let me break away for a moment or two. Earlier this week, we reported how a brand new social housing development just outside Antrim has curbstones painted red, white and blue. The Union flag and Northern flags have also been put up around the housing development. Now it appears posters have been put on the windows of the new homes. Some of them say it's not racist to look after your own. The housing comprises around 14 units for families and wheelchair users. The PSNI have told this programme that they have not received any complaint in relation to the curbstones being painted. 030 30 80 55 55 is the number this morning. Dr. Dominic Bryan was chair of the Commission on Flags, Identity, Culture and Tradition. Dominic, thank you for waiting for us and thanks for being with us today.
That's all right.
What's your reaction to what's happening in this housing development, Dominic?
I'm afraid this is a very common story. Your show would have covered these sort of things many times. We live in a divided society, and although people must have the right to commemorate and celebrate their cultural identity, the things that are important to them, we also have a level of coercion in our society. And those two things get widely mixed together so that it becomes very hard to separate what is coercive behavior and what is commemorative behavior. I have looked at this over many years, probably 30 to 35 years I've been watching. I've seen many a time where a flag, sometimes just one flag, tricolor or union flag, gets put out outside a new estate to demarcate it before people move on in. And I'm afraid this has been a routine practice over much of the country for a long time.
And what do we do about it?
Well, the commission, I think, has a whole set of reasonable ways of moving forward. We couldn't agree on all of them. Let me go through a few. Firstly, nobody has the legal authority to put flags up. Under the 1993 Roads Act, you have no authority to put a flag or an emblem up on a lamp.
Well, I'll tell you what, it seems nobody has a legal authority to take them down.
Well, that needs delving into, because that's a relationship that's usually between the Department of Infrastructure and the police. And to be blunt with you, they pretty much agreed not to move forward on the law. So the law gets ignored in this case, which I always think is quite an interesting place for agencies to end up in. In the commission, we pointed this out and we came up with seven or eight broad, what we think are reasonable ways of moving forward. We've suggested that placing flags should never endanger the safety of road users. That residents in areas where flags displayed can reasonably expect to know when they should be who put them up and when they should be taken down. A national flag should never be defiled or burned. A flag should never be flown in a warm or damaged condition. No flag should be used in a way that reasonably construed as antagonistic, such as around an interface. And I think a new property development would fall into this. No flag should be flown around places where public services are delivered. No flag should be placed in any way that appears intimidatory or threatening. And I think that would include paramilitary flags. And lastly, and I think importantly, that whilst flags should be used around commemoration and celebration, that it should be close to the dates that are events are being celebrated in July, August and Easter. So it should be time bound. And I would challenge anybody to think that those broad set of principles were unreasonable. And the question comes, do we have the policymakers and the politicians who will take that forward?
Dominic, thank you very much. I know you need to go this morning. Thank you very much indeed for talking to us today. Cathy, we heard from on yesterday's programme, you were refused one of the houses. You refused one of the houses, Cathy. You turned one of them down because of these flags and painted curbstones. Good morning again, Cathy.
Morning, Stephen. Thanks for having me back on.
Now, the police have told this programme they didn't receive any complaint. You're saying you have a crime number.
Initially, Stephen, yes, I rang up 101 to make an inquiry about whose department it was, really, to remove the flags. And I just want to be clear before we go on any further. Like, flags and identity and culture, tradition of other people is totally fine. I mean, that's what community is. But nobody really has a right to put symbols of identity up anywhere on a place before anyone's moved in. I don't have an issue with anybody, celebrating their culture. But to mark an area, those flags were used as intimidation. And the police did receive a report from me. So I really
did. They receive a complaint from you?
Well, I phoned up the inquiry and they gave me a crime reference number. So I think they're being quite tactical with the words that they're using.
Well, why would they do that? Like,
I really have no idea. I mean, the facts are it's illegal for the 1983 Roads Act. The police shouldn't need any report anyway. They can see the law is being broken with their own eyes. It's just another case of being another blind eye being turned.
Here's the statement from the police. The painting of curbstones could... Police are aware of curbstones having been painted in the Belfast Road area of Antrim. The painting of curbstones could potentially be classed as criminal damage. Every situation's taken on its own merits. Well, what are you... Look, what is happening in this country? Every
Hold on a minute.
Now I'm speaking directly to the PSNI this morning. Every situation's taken on its own merits. Why this round and round and round about language? You're talking to us, the community, who you are partnering up with. That's not an abstract situation. The specific situation is the painting of curbstones red, white and blue. Is that criminal damage or not? So someone goes out in their housing estate, it's supposed to be a mixed area, and they paint them red, white and blue. Why won't you call it out, PSNI? You are part of our community. Do you think that there is sufficient evidence that for whoever painted those curbstones, if you could find them, that you would be interested in investigating them? Why this abstract language? When we're all trying to work together to drive racism out of this country. The police continue in their statement after saying every situation is taken on its own merits when they damn well know that we're talking about people here being intimidated out of a specific estate. Next in their statement, the PSNI say the upkeep and maintenance of curbstones is a matter for the Department of Infrastructure. Well, this isn't about upkeep and maintenance, is it? It's not about upkeep of it or maintenance of it. It's about the potential crime of intimidating people out of an area. The police say currently we have not received a statement of complaint in respect of the curbstones in this development. Well, look, Cathy, I'd like to see the paperwork. I'd like to see the crime number. I'd like to go back to the PSNI and interrogate how on earth you have a crime number and they're saying no complaint's been made.
That's fine, Stephen. I can pass that over for you, no problem.
Thanks a lot. I don't know. I just don't know. We're fighting here for people who are being driven out of being able to go and live in a home with their family and their children. Remember that the removal of flags ain't the responsibility of the police. They will only seek to have flags removed when they constitute evidence of offences or where they're assessed risks to public safety owing to their erection. Well, that's open for interpretation as well, isn't it? Is it a risk to public safety if you don't have a house and you can't put a roof over your children's head because of people marking out territory? I don't know. Next, the school year might be coming to a close this week, but for some parents of children with special educational needs, they've been left fighting to get answers if their child has a school place this September. We know the Education Minister, Paul Given, last week spoke about how the amount of send children still waiting for a decision on their preschool and primary place was in the hundreds. A week later, many are still waiting. One of those parents, Lisa McCartney. Good morning, Lisa.
Good morning, Stephen.
How's your son, Jamie?
Well, we're just not good at the minute. Our whole family's just completely stressed to the absolute max. I'll give you a wee bit of background on Jamie. So he's 4. He's a diagnosis of autism, severe learning difficulty, communication, social interaction difficulty, social behavioural difficulty. He's nonverbal. He's still in nappies. He has a full statement of educational needs. I'm not sure if you're aware, but the national IQ for kids his age is between 90 and 110. Jamie's sitting at 43, which gives him a severe mental impairment. Last year, we didn't get placed. I had countless emails and calls back and forth to the EA. I didn't get any setting for Jamie. I ended up finding out by phoning the school myself that I had applied for, and they told me that he didn't get a place. This is before the EA had communicated this to me. I ended up having to go down to their office last August with a group of mummies in the same predicament as me, and we refused to leave. And because of that, my son was given back into his 2 to 3 year programme. It was a setting that had never had a nursery before, but because there was nowhere else to put him, he was put there. Fast forward a year later, and after being promised that because of everything that we were put through last year, Jamie would be a priority, I'm in exactly the same position. as it stands now, the two schools that I chose, Jamie was turned down due to postcode and not being close enough. But the schools that I applied for are the closest schools, for special needs schools, to me.
How old is Jamie?
Jamie's four.
So there's Jamie's no school place for him this September?
There's no school place. So I got an email last night at 5 to 8 from my link officer to offer Jamie offered him a mainstream, a unit within a mainstream. I am absolutely horrified that I have went to so much. You know, I'm constantly fighting. I'm rallying. I was in Stormont a few Mondays ago. I cannot do anything else. The fight and the worry and the stress that I am under, and I mean emailing absolutely every day, and the majority of those emails are going unresponded. And to offer my child a mainstream, considering that his GAC scores are sitting at 43, a severe mental impairment in a mainstream school with a child who doesn't speak, who's still in nappies, is absolutely ridiculous that they would think that's okay. As far as I'm concerned, it's, you know, they're just putting my son wherever they have free. And I contacted this school, I'm not going to name it, but I contacted this school this morning, really concerned and went to the principal, and the principal was absolutely horrified that the school would be given a child with such low scoring. They were completely unaware that my son was as severe as what he was, but the EA are still trying to push to put these kids in these mainstream schools.
What? So the school that the EA is recommending,
yeah,
the principal of that same school has told you they are horrified at the prospect they're not being rude about that, but they're horrified because they cannot cope with your child's needs. Is that right?
They were completely unaware of the severity of Jamie's needs. She is still waiting on the consultation being sent forward, and she says that she's going to have a read through it, but she was completely unaware of the severity of Jamie's needs. So the EA were willingly about to put my son in a mainstream school that would not have been able to cope with him.
Well, look, we're going to have to follow that up as well and just not let any of this go. So we're going to have to go back and ask the Education Authority to investigate and confirm whether it is or it is not true that they're now sending a child to a school where the principal is not aware of that child's educational needs. We'll follow that up. Lisa, thank you. We'll be back. I promise we will. Before we go today, our top story today, if you missed it, it's on BBC Sounds. Katie, a nurse, strangled in a hospital. The PPS write to her to tell her that they're prosecuting the alleged perpetrator, and then write to her to say they're not because of medical evidence presented by the defence. Katie's father has contacted us. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Good morning, Jim. I know you've told my colleagues here you're emotional.
Bit of a hard lesson this morning, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, it is.
Your little girl not able to sleep and doesn't feel safe.
There was a wee point missing that Katie herself hadn't mentioned. And I thought it was worth it just phoning India. Katie has been brought up riding ponies and horses. So I'm just wanting to put the point over. Katie is only a size 8, but she's as strong as an ass. And that's why this guy wasn't able to overpower. So after the incident and the aftermath of it, and coming home, telling us what had happened, after it was talked through, her first thought was, after that initial thing, her first thought was, what if? And what I mean by that is, what if she wasn't as strong as she was? What would have happened? What if it had been the wee girl that was changing the bed and the door had somehow closed over and she was in that room by herself? Or what if in 6 months' time, this guy is in again? And
well, she believes he may come back. She believes when she was passing him that he intimated that he may do this again, is what she believes. But well, she couldn't believe the exact she couldn't remember the exact language, so she's hesitant to go beyond. It was a thought that occurred to her.
That was because it's probably off the. It was immediate after the incident. You know, the shock was still present. And she had a phone herself. Because at that particular time, she was working for an agency when it happened. She had a phone in place herself. The hospital wouldn't do it.
Well, obviously, I would need to look into the detail. Look, we all heard this morning the long-lasting impact as a victim on your daughter. Are you frightened for her? Are you frightened this could happen again to her?
If you knew me as a person, there's nothing frightens me. But whenever you have 3 years, her big sister is a midwife, and that was part of what made Katie look at this as a career. Or she is a caring leader, but as a parent, you think when you get them to 18 and they're out in the world to make their own way, you think you have them reared. So for her, I would be scared that maybe next time she's not just as sharp or ready for it or whatever you like to call it, you know. But Katie is a girl that is not selfish, so she's thinking about the what if, what about the next one? What about the next week or as well? You know what I mean?
The Public Prosecution Service have now said that they're reviewing their decision after Katie has given this interview to this programme. Do you have...
Do you know when that happened?
We were told last night, Jim, so... They've done it in response to the details we've given them about the interview Katie has publicly said.
My daughter was driving home at this minute in time. She is in a placement, and she was driving home through the Belfast traffic last night when she got that phone call from CPS. So that's when she found out, and that's how she found out that they were going to look into it.
I know she told me in the interview that you told her not to give up. I'm so glad she came to the BBC. And we will fight for her to get the answers that she needs to try and get some closure.
It's not, if you just don't give up, it's a life lesson.
Listen, we'll stay in touch. We'll stay in touch, and we'll stay in touch with this story. Is that all right?
Okay. Yeah, Stephen.
Okay. Look, thanks.
I can't thank you enough for doing what you've done already.
It's a pleasure.
So you keep up the fight.
All right.
And we'll not give up.
Thanks very much. Thank you very much indeed. The relation to the Education Authority and the Special Educational Needs Child doesn't have a place. They're pointing out to us that each child's placement is managed on a personal and individual basis, and the EA works with family schools and settings to ensure a suitable place is secured. But we still need to go back and ask what that mother's now claiming, that the school principal has said she's horrified at the prospect of having to try to find some type of facilities to deal with her child given the needs that they've got. And that's not that principal being rude, that's that principal being surprised, is what the mother's claiming. Listen, I'm off for a couple of weeks. I had tickets for the McGregor fight, and then McGregor, of course, cancelled his fight. But I'll see you in a couple of weeks' time. So you look after yourselves, and thank you very much indeed for listening. Hopefully I'll be back with a better voice as well. See you soon.
The biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet at Stephen Nolan. Stephen Nolan Show!